Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Anofowakian.
This week, the NSA hacks El Presidente, Windows 8.1 launches and unlaunches, Nokia's new Lumia, and Apple's fall cornucopia of product offerings. All this and more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. And please add us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show's also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I just wanted to briefly update you guys on last week, I believe. I had talked about I was in the middle of building a MAME cabinet, which is the Multiple Arcade Machine Emulator, which is essentially a program that allows you to emulate coin-op machines, all sort of coin-op machines based on if you have the proper ROMs. If you have the coin-op ROMs, which is essentially a digital version of the physical ROM boards. It's essentially the program of the coin-op game. This MAME emulator will play them as if you were playing the actual coin-op machine, arcade machine, but on your own computer.
So what you're basically saying, you're taking an old... You have like a computer.
Yes.
And because those arcade coin-operated machines are so old school, a current computer can emulate the entire machine in software. So you've got some sort of program that allows you to emulate multiples of those older machines. So you can basically have one physical console and a whole bunch of machines. You're virtualizing it, sort of.
Yes, I'm virtualizing it. And what I did was I took an old server that I had, which is a Pentium 4 system that I built within a shuttle case, so it's a really small square case, put in a hard drive, a 300 gig hard drive with literally every single coin-op ROM that had ever existed from a period of like from the beginning of arcade through about like the mid 90s or 2000s or so. Like a broad range of coin-op arcade game ROMs are in this one archive that's actually online, and it's available, I believe, for free. There's no sort of legal, there doesn't seem to be any legal restrictions to accessing this database. So I put that whole database of games onto this this hard drive, loaded it in the shuttle case, put that whole case within an actual full-size coin-op cabinet that a friend of mine works for a company that refurbishes arcade machines. And this was one that they were throwing out, but it was completely intact. And
why were they throwing it out? What's wrong with it?
Well, the guts of it, the first of all, there's a sort of like a life cycle for these machines. After a number of years, they're just no good anymore. And in general, people, you know, there's a lot of in general, arcade coin-op machines have gone through like a they've fallen out of use. They've fallen out of use. So they have scores of these cabinets around that they don't need anymore because nobody's asking for arcade cabinets in their places of commerce, because people play video games on consoles. The consoles essentially killed
your phone.
The consoles and your phone, in, you know, one after another, killed the arcade coin-op essentially. So this is a throwback to an earlier era. So He had this.
I'd love to have one in my home, actually.
Exactly. I'm just really surprised that there's not an aftermarket for these, for this kind of application. There's got to be. I mean, if these things are not expensive, I don't know how much the actual box is with no hardware.
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, there is a company, I believe it's a startup in San Francisco, where there's, and I don't recall if we spoke about this on the podcast before, but they're trying to rent out arcade cabinets to people.
Really?
For reasonably cheap prices. Huh. So people could get that old school feel.
If you have a party, you throw a party, you have a couple of these arcade cabinets, you know, you have a 30 people at your party, so you have three of them.
Yeah.
They've all got your MAME software on it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, that'll work, because then people can take turns and people aren't just waiting along the lines. I get it. I'm just saying that, like, your buddy's company, I can see a whole bunch of people, you know, taking advantage.
They've you know, since the downfall of the coin-op video game, they've gotten into the business of jukeboxes in, like, there's jukeboxes that you can put in bars that are essentially
big MP3 machines.
Yes, big MP3 machines that are controlled, that you can control with your own smartphone as well. So they've gotten into that business, really. They've kind of cast aside the coin-op business. It's a secondary business for them. So they were throwing out this cabinet. I have this cabinet now. The important thing is the glass, the cabinet itself, and the controls, and the arcade controls are still intact. So all I needed to do is put the computer in there with the MAME software and figure out an interface to connect the computer to the legacy arcade controls. And there is one online.
So it's basically you go out and you buy some USB-connected...
Yes.
Board or something?
Yes, exactly. It's a board that connects to the legacy arcade controls, between the legacy arcade controls, and uses a USB interface to connect to the computer. And then the computer recognizes the arcade controls as if it was the actual arcade board, and drop in a monitor, and it works like a dream. And
what do you got for a monitor? You have like a, what are you using? Like some old CRT? Just you got a flat screen in there? What do you got?
It's an LCD monitor. It's a like a 20-inch LCD monitor. It's square monitor. You throw it up against the inside of the cabinet, and you would not know that it wasn't the actual, like, the original monitor. It looks pretty.
These original games, they're not playing in crazy high resolution, so any monitor you've got.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Buy it.
Yep. Yep, the games play fairly well. You know, there are some games that are a little sort of that play a little spottily because the emulation isn't perfect, and other games where the original controls for the games were like driving wheels or trackballs don't exactly play nicely with the controls that are in the cabinet, which is a joystick and buttons. But that's, you can't help that.
So, but, is there an interface, like, if you had gotten another cabinet? Mm-hmm. With a wheel,
yep,
or a trackball,
yep,
with that little interface device that you have that's connected to the USB, would it talk to those as well?
Absolutely, yep.
Wow, so you're saying you can get like three cabinets, one with the wheel,
yeah,
one with the normal joystick, and one with the trackball joystick situation, plug up a computer, or three computers in this case, to all of them, and you'd have like a really, you'd have a superior arcade in your house.
Yep, yep.
That sounds,
but as it is, fun. This plays like 3,000 plus games off of, and you can work it. You can even work the trackball in the driving games with the steering, with the joystick in a sort of half-assed sort of way.
Yeah, someone in a bunch of, I think it was our back-end engineering team at Box, actually put together an arcade cab as well, and they actually built the entire cabinet itself too, which is pretty awesome. But it brings me back to the days when on my original Xbox, I had modded that to be able to play emulators and had all those original console games. It takes you back, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, even the Ouya has some emulation, functionality. I know that the Ouya, for those who don't know, is a Kickstarter project that is an Android-based, ARM-based device that is a game console for about $100. And Andy, you're familiar a little bit with the emulation on that, aren't you?
With the Ouya, yeah, I have the Ouya, and it does have a great little emulator on it. You throw some ROMs on there, and it works just like, it'll emulate like the old SNES, and there's an SNES, an Atari 2600, And I believe there's a couple other emulators on there, but the SNES and the 2600 ones work the best.
Mm.
Yeah.
Sounds good. So yeah, powerful emulation. You've got your cabinet working. This is in your home or this is in your office?
This is I brought this into my office, into my workplace, and it's in a shared area in my workplace. When I'm done with the project, I'll have to have it carted out of the workplace, and then my wife has pretty much told me that it can only go in the garage once it comes home. So I have to find some room in the garage to put it, clear some room out in the garage so I can have it in there. But it should be nice.
Hey, man, it's like a museum piece. I don't know why she'd want to hide it away, but you know what? As long as you can hold on to it, it's great when you can put something together with your own hands, especially in an era where, you know, like, let's face it, 10 years ago, I was building a Pentium 4 system.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you go out, you do all the research. The SSD drives had really, you know, they were out of reach, so you're trying to, like, find a way to hack really big amounts of RAM to make it work like that kind of shit. And it's, you know, we don't make computers anymore. We don't make working devices anymore. No, not electronics anyway.
Nobody builds these things by hand anymore.
Exactly. Like, I'm at a place where now I will buy furniture and refinish it because I need that handiwork. And it used to be that I'd get my hands all inside of a machine and, you know, the screws. And, you know, back in the day, you put some toggle switches on that puppy and some lights and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But now it's more like you know, if you're gonna build something, it has to be one of those things that's only built because the machines are all SSD and all that stuff and nothing to it.
Anyway, that was that short update. Tosin, you've got a really exciting thing. I'm really excited to hear about this, about what you've played with within the last couple of days, right?
Yeah, this is actually yesterday. So this isn't really me playing with the device, but this is me revisiting an old treasured friend and bringing that experience to other people. And by that, I mean I shared with a group of people Star Wars A New Hope.
Wow.
So just a little background. Within the office, I found that there were several people who have never seen a Star Wars film before.
These people, you call them terrorists.
These are some sort of foreigners who have been living under a rock for 30 years.
Actually,
I
guess
I don't understand how you can be an American and not enjoy Star Wars.
Funny enough, one of them had only seen Episode 1. That was their only Star Wars experience.
Oh, were they tortured? Is that torture?
Well, Episode 1
that sounds like an extraordinary rendition.
So, first of all, let me ask, how did this guy ever agree to watch another Star Wars movie after seeing Jar Jar Binks?
Well, luckily she didn't recall it too well, which is probably a good thing. But I think there are several really awesome things about it. For one, the people involved were gung-ho about seeing Star Wars, and so they actually scheduled it on my work calendar that we were going to make this happen, so... props to them for going out.
I mean, that's just like normal American brainwashing. You have to have people watch Star Wars. Like, that's just like, that's just patriotic right there.
It's part of the American cultural experience.
It's just, you know, it's like there's Jesus and there's Star Wars.
In that order, roughly.
I don't even know.
We settled down and... watch Star Wars, and just for a little preface, what I'm going to put them through is the Machete Order. I know I discussed that last week, where it's episodes 4, 5, 2, 3, 6.
You don't even bother with three,
one.
So when you say 4, 5, 2, 3, 6, what you really mean is 1, 2, right?
Yeah.
And then
A New Hope. Empire Strikes Back.
One, Star Wars. Then you go to The Empire Strikes Back. Then you skip to 2002's Attack of the Clones, 2003's Attack of the Clones. Then you go to the Revenge of the Sith from 2005 or so. And then you jump all the way back to like 1983 with the Return of the Jedi.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's not use numbers, people.
Okay. The reason behind is, since a lot of them have never seen it before, I'm just curious how this has been dubbed the Machete Order, seeing how it works for me as well as for them. But anyway, we watched. I actually made sure we got the Despecialized 2.5 release.
Oh, nice!
Of the New Hope.
And for anyone who doesn't know, it means that George Lucas has changed the movies over the years. He's revised them, so to speak. Yeah. We call it censorship in my world. And these unspecialized versions managed to keep the most of what was available of the original airing in the highest possible quality.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so there were earlier releases of it, 1.0 for all the other movies, but not too long ago, I believe it was earlier this year, they released a 2.5 release, which is basically like a 17 gig version of A New Hope, which is very awesome. Very well done.
Edited by regular people who basically they're film buffs. They've got access to editing software. They've got, you know, just like how people have vinyl collections and other things, they have collections of these Star Wars movies in their various incarnations, and they've found a way to digitally edit the pieces together, to sew them together in order to create the best possible version based on their aspect and their outlook from a fandom perspective.
Yeah, and they're very passionate about it, which is really awesome. It's very cool to know. So our group originally started as a smaller group of people who were watching it, but it just continued to grow. Like I said, we ultimately ended up with, I believe it was four people in that room who hadn't seen it, and then, of course, surrounded by other people who had seen it. And what was actually pretty funny is we were watching it in a room which had a clear glass walls, and people would walk by and stop and like start watching or come in or like give us the thumbs up, or it was a pretty communal experience, even like people who were not associated with Box. So in terms of the movies, it was like this was one of the best experiences I've had in such a long time, because I was really reliving my childhood through the experience of other people. It might be similar to, you know, having kids and showing them Star Wars for the first time, but it was like the reactions that we were getting were so unique and priceless. I started to take notes at a point. There was I would say about half of them had never heard of any Star Wars references or never noticed them. So, you know, I remember when Luke is with Obi-Wan, and Obi-Wan gives him his father's lightsaber, and he turns it on for the first time.
Yeah.
Like, they all were like, whoa. Like, that was like the collective noise that was echoed through that room. And I was just like,
Making that same noise in 1977.
Yes. Yes. And then, like, of course, and here is one of the most epic things that I could recall to happen in a while. Mm-hmm. So, given that these are the despecialized editions where Han Solo shoots first, at the time that Han shoots Greedo first, like several of them were like, oh my God. And like they were like, that's amazing. Just because he was like so.
He's a badass.
Badass. Yeah. And I'm like, yes, that is why everyone complained due to the change, because it was just fit the character so well.
That's what characters do. They're characters. Like, he made an archetype.
Yeah.
And then he tried to destroy that archetype in order to sell things.
Ugh.
That is blasphemy.
There were just so many other priceless reactions. Like, when Obi-Wan died, they were all just like, is he dead? Did he really die? Oh. Is that what happens when you, like, do you disappear like that? Or, like, with Darth Vader, they're like, is he human under there? Like, just really interesting commentary throughout the journey, and just really, I'd call it just pure reactions. That is something that you may like. I remember experiencing this as a little kid. Yeah, exactly. And so it's just
become part of our culture. I'm actually sure that there are probably a bunch of people who noticed things in that showing. Like, I never knew that came from Star Wars, like popular cultural references and so on and so forth. That's what I noticed.
A lot of that. And so we're going to continue it in a couple of weeks with Empire Strikes Back, which I'm really...
Oh, my gosh.
I am really interested to see what they make of with the whole
Oh yeah,
it's just gonna be so amazing when that hits home.
Well, that and the fact that it is the best movie ever.
Yeah, yeah. In my opinion, also yes.
No, I mean, I'm not talking. It's the best Star Wars movie, fine. But I would say that in my world, Empire Strikes Back is in the top five greatest films of all time.
That's a bold statement. I wouldn't completely disagree. You've never experienced that kind of
exposure, you know. And for its time, you know, just like for The Godfather Part II, for its time, you're like, I can't believe that happened. It's so good that it becomes culturally relevant for like so many other things, and it begins the current geek era that we're in terms of like geek culture.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's the Bible.
Yeah. So. Extraordinary experience. If you ever get a chance and you find people who are motivated and dedicated to watch it, I think it's a great thing to do. And I will keep you guys posted on how the entire trilogy goes. You know, once they find out that they're siblings, as well as some of the other ultimate twists in this film. But they all came out and said, you know, we're really glad that I showed it to them and are really interested in seeing the rest of them. So.
Oh yeah, I'm excited to hear you report on how their reaction, what their reaction is.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's get into some of the headlines here. The NSA has been systematically eavesdropping on the Mexican government for years. It appears they hacked into the president's public email account. The NSA has a division for particularly difficult missions called the Tailored Access Operations, or TAO, unit. They devise special methods for special targets, and one of those targets includes neighboring Mexico. In a report leaked by whistleblower Edward Snowden that was classified top secret, the report said that the TAO successfully exploited a key mail server in the Mexican Presidencia domain within the Mexican presidential network to gain first ever access to President Felipe Calderon's public email account. The operation dubbed Flat Liquid is likely to trigger deeper controversy, especially since the NSA's snooping took place during President Calderon's term, and he was a leader who worked more closely with Washington than any other Mexican president before him. So this is how we treat our friends, apparently. Pretty damning stuff coming out of the NSA leaks again.
Now it wasn't. I could very well be making this up. It's been a while since I've had history. So, but wasn't it in the past that U.S. actually, the U.S. government helped certain individuals get into power in Mexico?
Yeah, I mean the Calderon election is particularly was seen. Very much as one that was not necessarily the one the people wanted, but it certainly helped the United States' interest. It was the person that we wanted to win in terms of the administration at the time. There is some suspiciousness around that, just like there was some suspiciousness around Vicente Fox. Mexico is a pure prime example of what happens when your politics is just not it's not done well. They don't have. They've had very few. Normal elections. And when you look at the fact that the country is on the border of our Southwest, has the same resources that we do, in some cases better resources, you wonder why they're not doing better. And in many ways, it's because of their politics and the corruption. Now, they've also got people cutting off other people's heads and setting them up. They've got gun runners. They've got all these other things. And there's a lot of corruption in Mexico. So I'm not going to lie. If the NSA is looking to do the protection of America and all that stuff with this illegal wiretapping stuff, then Mexico seems like a pretty good target because drugs are coming up there, money's moving around. You know, there's just no way of telling exactly what's going on, and that's the kind of thing that they want an insight to. That's their chief modus operandi. Do we not know what's going on? Okay, how can we hack it?
It's bound to put a strain on international relationships with not only with Mexico but with other countries as well who all have to, at this point, be thinking, well, if they've done it to Mexico, certainly they've done it to us as well.
It's even bigger than that, Andy. Today, October 23rd, President Obama had to openly tell Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany that America, the United States, is not spying on her, is not hacking into her stuff. Because there was a there's basically a report from European newspapers that said that that was the case. The French newspaper Le Monde, mm-hmm. The World, has come out with multiple damning accusations against the United States and wiretapping and so on. So we're in a position where the president is being strained. He's being weakened in internationally while trying to move the international community forward because of these processes that either he knew about or he didn't know about, but the fact is he's ultimately responsible for.
Hmm.
This is what happens when the technology is abused.
Yeah. And again, like I ask every time something like this pops up on our show, is that will it change? Will it affect enough? Will it, you know, incite enough people to change the way that what NSA's do, what the NSA is doing?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. We have to wonder. There was a time when you were able to do things like, I don't know if you guys have ever seen this Game of Thrones show or read the books, but there was a time when there was something called Rite of Conquest, where you can go and you can do whatever you want because you were strong enough. Sure. That pretty much died in the 20th century when we started calling those kinds of actions wars of aggression. What we're doing on the internet could be seen by many people as a war of aggression, and it could strike the kind of pushback that really gets us in trouble internationally.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, moving on here. Nokia has just made its latest Lumia 1520 official with 6-inch display. It's the biggest Windows phone ever. It has 1080p resolution. It's a first for Microsoft's mobile operating system. If you thought the 4.5-inch display on Nokia's previous range of Lumia devices was large, the 1520 dwarfs it in comparison. The Microsoft's 1080p support allows for 3 columns of live tiles on the start screen, as well as improvements to built-in apps, allowing Mail and others to use more of the screen. It's powered by Qualcomm's quad-core Snapdragon 800 processor. So it's a pretty big screen. Everyone's moving bigger and bigger on these phones. We had this conversation, a sideline conversation, I think, with you and me and Devendra were involved in this, about how there's sort of a workaround for apps, for menus that are too big for the tablet for you to reach your thumb across.
Yeah, so this isn't Samsung phones. The Samsung Galaxy Note 2 and 3, I believe,
yeah,
have a version of the software that allows you to basically put it into one hand mode, and that makes it so that when you hit that functionality, it will downsize the screen from the whatever corner, from like the upper right corner or the upper left corner, so that the visible workable screen is hanging out at like 4 inches, 4.5 inches. That way your thumb can get across the whole entire screen, so basically like shrinks down what you're looking at. It's pretty strange, because one would think that someone buys a big phone to take advantage of the big phone.
Yeah.
But it also goes to show that sometimes these things are just so large that hands can't go across them. It's a fairly interesting, if not innovative, way to solve the problem of getting the best of both worlds if you're into the bigger phones. And frankly, as a guy who walks around with a pair of jeans on all the time, yeah, you know, the big phones appeal to me a little less. But, you know, if I could see, and I have seen, that you're a woman, you've got a purse, you're pulling out your phone anyway, you care less about the size because you're not exactly trying to, like, you know, you've got to carry this thing anyway, it's got all your other stuff in it. It's not a terrible thing to have these bigger phones.
Hmm.
In fact, I've even heard some people say that they wish the iPad mini could be their phone because they like that.
Wow.
Size. It's kind of an all-in-one device. And they can, you know, if they really need to, they can put in a pair of earphones or a Bluetooth headset, and they can do that talking then. So there's something to that.
I think for me, a phone should be ergonomically comfortable. And anything larger than your physical hand is no longer ergonomic.
Well, it's not ergonomic for you. But I guess the point is that if you're a person who doesn't need to, you're not trying to fit a phone in your pocket, or you're doing the stuff that you do on your phone much like how you would on a tablet,
yeah,
you know, that size is not a problem for you. You'd prefer to have one device with that size than have a tablet and a phone. Let's face it, the Galaxy Note 3 has done very, very well. That's why these guys are copying it. It's a great device. People really enjoy it, and it established that this phablet thing really works. So, you know, you can't knock it until you really get into it.
There's a market for it, for sure.
And also, let's just face it. Different people have different hands. You don't buy the same pair of gloves for everybody. So in addition to the whole use case thing, it's okay if phones are smaller or bigger. There are people who prefer, like, you know, my girlfriend's got small hands. She prefers the size of the iPhone 4S to the iPhone 5. She's like, man, I got to reach my thumb all the way up there.
Yeah.
And there is something to be said about the fact that this one-size-fits-all thing doesn't really work. It's not a baseball cap, and even if it were, that wouldn't work either. So I just feel like we kind of have to keep an open mind about different use cases, different ways of knowing when it comes to this stuff. And it's going to be interesting once Apple moves into a place where it doesn't have two-size phones, if people are going to speak out about that. You know, different people, different sizes, different use cases. It's a whole, you know, diversity matters.
Microsoft's latest operating system, Windows 8.1, is now available. The new update brings back at least one of the familiar touches that users missed after the company launched its major system overhaul, Windows 8, which is the Start button. Now, the Start button doesn't actually, like the old legacy Windows 7 Start button, opens up a menu on the system level, on the Finder level, as it were, and
the Explorer level.
The Explorer level.
Yes,
I'm confusing confusing OSs. The Explorer level, which opened up, you know, where you can open up menus for your programs and other applications. This Start button just swaps between the Metro interface and the Explorer interface. But apart from the Start button, there are other changes in Windows 8.1. Support for gesture control, ability to control the size of tiles on the Start screen, better support for multitasking, and other improvements aimed at making computers run more efficiently. The Windows RT 8.1 update, though, didn't fare so well. Late Friday afternoon, Microsoft pulled the RT 8.1 update because users were complaining that of completely bricked machines, including Microsoft Surface RT machines, after applying the RT to RT 8.1 upgrade.
I mean, that's like crying shame.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You update, like I haven't been the biggest fan of iOS 7 because I feel like there's certain aspects of it that are not updates. But when your stuff doesn't work, like it just stops working.
Yeah.
And it's a critical device.
Yeah.
That's painful. That's a really difficult pain point. So, you know, I really hope Microsoft figures that out and can find a way to give some sort of remuneration to the people who have had to suffer. I know that when you buy a device, when you upgrade a device, you're taking risks and everything.
Yeah.
But we're in an age where you got to trust somebody, if not the people who make your OS. So, you know?
Yep. Especially if you're paying that much for the device and you're paying for the software too, which is...
What was the software cost to move from 8 to 8.1?
I think it was... I don't know.
Usually the...
With 8.1, I believe it was free.
Right, because usually those service packs, those point releases are not paid for Windows.
Yeah.
Now, we'll talk about operating system prices later on in the show, but it is important to understand that, you know, when you do pay for something, you expect a bit more than when it is for free.
Right.
In fact, when it's for free, you expect a lot less, and you might get a lot less.
All right, well, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is called The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon by Brad Stone. This is the definitive story of Amazon.com, one of the most successful companies in the world, and of its driven, brilliant founder, Jeff Bezos. Author Brad Stone enjoyed unprecedented access to current and former Amazon employees and Bezos family members, giving Audible listeners the first in-depth fly-in-the-wall account of life at Amazon. The Everything Store promises to be the revealing definitive biography of the company that placed one of the first and largest bets on the internet and forever changed the way we shop and read. I'm interested in this, in particular, in this book, because it's like, this is like the Steve Jobs biography was to Apple.
No, I don't think so.
No,
Steve Jobs Steve Jobs' story is done. He died.
Yeah.
Amazon has, you know, Jeff Bezos is young. He's vital.
Sure.
You know, this is on its way up.
But we haven't really seen.
It's a much shorter tail in some respect, because Amazon has been around since the late 90s, and Apple's been around since the 70s. So I think that they're, you know, with Steve Jobs, you're looking at Steve Jobs. With this book, you're actually looking at Amazon fueled by Bezos, but it's more about Amazon. And it can't end with the definitive situation that the Jobs books have ended in. So I don't think it's quite the same. I think it's too easy to say that.
Sure, but it is the deepest, most intimate look that we've had so far.
In that respect, I would have to agree, yeah.
In any case, to download that or any of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook, plus the 30-day trial to check out their service. If you don't like the Audible service at all, if you hate it, you still get to keep that book for free.
One small disclosure, Audible is owned by Amazon, no?
That's correct. Yes.
All right. So there's a little bit of we're covering Amazon. Yeah. They are a sponsor of the show. Just wanted to put that out there.
Absolutely. And thanks for clearing that up. Yeah, absolutely. That's true. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, Apple's fall event hit this week. And as they said, there was a lot to cover. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Onufuwakin. Apple's latest tech event proved to be a huge affair with the introduction of several new products as well as updates to its software suite for personal computers, tablets, and smartphones. So let's recap what they talked about today, and we're going to go in order that they announced it. So first of all, they refreshed the MacBook Pro line. They've got the 13-inch Mac Pro is lighter by at 3.46 pounds, thinner, runs quicker, runs a fourth-generation dual-core Haswell chip from Intel. They claim run 90% faster. It's cheaper, starting at $1,299 instead of $1,399. The 15-inch MacBook Pro uses Intel's Crystal Well chip, which I've never heard of before. Improved graphics and up to 8 hours of battery life. It includes faster flash storage, Wi-Fi, Thunderbolt 2. Starts at $1,999, down from $2,199 from the previous generation. What did you guys think about these new updates on these MacBook Pros?
I think, you know, making it slightly thinner, like the current MacBook Pro is relatively thin, but still very still kind of hefty, at least compared to the Air. But making it thinner and making it even more powerful is never a bad thing, especially you know, as an organization. Well, not as an organization,
display MacBook Pro smaller than it was last year?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I think it's slightly thinner.
Oh, okay. I didn't see that at all, that the Retina displays were smaller. I do know that they quietly killed the 15-inch MacBook Pro, the one that came out in 2006, the unibody. That was quietly killed. The 13-inch remains. It's got technology, i5 technology. Third generation i5 technology from earlier this year in 2013 when they quietly updated it. But now the only 15-inch MacBook Pro is a MacBook Pro with Retina display. Now these are cheaper than they used to be. Yeah. They've dropped the price across the board by about $200. And that has a lot to do with the fact that they're going to sell in more volume. $200 doesn't sound like a lot when you're looking at a $2,500 computer, but you know, money is money where you can save it.
Absolutely.
So there is that. Thunderbolt 2, exciting. Two times faster than Thunderbolt 1. But frankly, the adoption of Thunderbolt devices hasn't been the super ubiquitous thing we've seen with USB.
Right.
So
right.
I don't really know how much of a game changer that's going to be, but if you've been looking for a computer, now's the time to buy, because Thunderbolt 2 probably won't change for some time. Yeah. If you're going to buy a device, it's going to work, it's backwards compatible, there's all that.
Yeah.
Even though it's a MacBook Pro, the 13-inch Retina version and the 13-inch normal version, they both only have built-in graphics processors. So they're running what's called, you know, Intel's Iris situation. So you got your Retina display and your Iris chip. So it's a whole eye thing. But really, you know, you're not getting that discrete graphics card. So if you're an old school guy, then that discrete graphics is only available for you on one of the higher end MacBook Pros 15s. And there you get 2 gigs. Now they've hooked up the way they do this whole integrated graphics card by mm-hmm. doing this whole thing with you know, they allow it more memory from your system. So you've got 8 gigs, your computer's using 6 gigs and your graphic card can be using up to 2 or something like that. But that said, it's still not the coup de grace when it comes to the way that we've been thinking about graphic chips and laptops for a while. You know, who knows? Some new reviews might show up and people, you know, might show that these chips in fact are really, really powerful. But if you're really gunning for the power, you're going to get that 15-inch.
Yeah. Yeah. I know nothing about this Crystalwell chip either. I've never – this is the first I've heard of it. It was when they announced it.
Okay, so Haswell is the chip that you see. It's the fourth generation Core i chip that you see in the desktop computers that have come sure. – you know, desktop-style computers that have come out in the most recent era. Haswell is a dual-core chip from what I understand, with Crystalwell being the quad-core version. So that's what we're seeing here. I think we can check that quickly if we hop into the specs for the Mac Pro, but that's for later. We'll sum that up on the we'll have to put a pin in that and sum it up on the show notes.
And speaking of the Mac Pro, they briefly went over the Mac Pro. They didn't have a lot more to say than when they had first announced it. It's it runs Intel Xeon E5 processor, has room for 1 terabyte of flash storage. No option for a traditional hard drive. It's external, if you want. It's manufactured in the U.S., first Apple computer to be assembled domestically in decades. It lists starting at $29.99 and will be available in December. So if you get $3,000 to plunk down and you are of a particular a professional bent that could use this sort of power, it's a lot of power in a very small machine.
But there's one thing to remember here. Yeah, it's $3,000. What you're getting for $3,000 is the base model. You're getting a quad-core machine, which is, definitely a better deal than if you want just raw power than some of the laptop stuff. But if you want to get the full Megillah, you're looking at a 12-core machine.
Yeah.
And something that's the size of a toaster on its end.
Yeah.
And that's really where it's impressive. Where it's not impressive, though, is – they've got this technology that allows you to spin the computer around in order to get to the ports.
Uh-huh.
But what you don't realize is that you've got your wall plug plugged in there when you're spinning it around. And I don't know about you, but if you're trying to move a computer with the plug in there. Now, and that is to say, you know, you got to be solution-oriented. How could they have changed that? Perhaps if the plug was on a static area and you could turn the I.O. part around without the plug moving,
interesting.
That would be more impressive. Now, am I nitpicking? Absolutely. But this is the biggest, best company in the world when it comes to this kind of stuff. So I feel like I have the right.
Yeah. But, you know, and we were talking a little bit about the show before the show about this, is that at the size, at the form factor that this Mac Pro is, it's practically a portable computer. I mean, It's like you know, you can easily take this to a LAN party with no effort at all, as opposed to the big sort of cheese grater of the previous generation Mac Pro, which is, you know, going to give you a hernia if you cart that thing around anywhere.
That computer is industrial beauty. I will never hear anything negative about that machine.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I own one. I love it. But it is a beast. It is a heavy, heavy beast.
It's supposed to be. It's reminiscent of, you know, steam locomotives, like the symbols of power in the 19th and 20th century. And that's what it should be. This new one is cute and it's great. And it's got the sexy airplane / Audi fast car, you know, advertising around it. It's got a lot of stuff. And yeah, great, great. But those older machines, they really had something. Now, you could say, yeah, I'm going to take this machine over to LAN party. But yeah, I want to see you easily pick up this machine and then easily pick up the hard drive that's holding the games. It's only got a terabyte of space. And easily pick up the keyboard, the mouse, and the Thunderbolt display that go with it.
Yeah, well, the display is another thing entirely. You're right about that. That we haven't heard anything about the displays for these, but they're expected to be 4K displays.
Yeah, I mean, it runs this machine and the MacBook Pro 15 will easily run 4K display, multiple 4K displays. In fact, the MacBook Pro 15 can also run crazy high resolutions from the HDMI port. Now, you're not going to be getting, you know, 60 hertz. But you're still getting some good chop there. So that's something to remember.
This will do four streams of 4K video simultaneously, which is insane.
Right. And it also, the Mac Pro, for those who didn't know, it's the first Mac that comes stock with dual video cards. So you're getting a lot of power out there. It's not like you're just plugging it in and you're crunching along at nothing with these 4K screens. You're really getting something that allows you to pull each of those cards is taking on two monitors at 4K, which is powerful. And the pricing is actually not that bad when you consider the fact that these machines you're getting these crazy cards, you're getting this crazy, you know, RAM, you're getting all this really tight hardware for, you know, an opening price of $3,000, and your expansion is really, really based on what you're plugging into it, since it is a desktop. So, you know, you've got the Drobo with the SSDs, you've got whatever you've got, and it really is kind of a for lack of a better term, a PlayStation. It's a station you can just play around with.
Right, right. I'd love to get some hands-on review of these machines once they're out. Really,
likewise, Apple, if you're listening.
Yeah, if you listen. Yeah, I'm a film editor, so I have a complete justification for having one of these.
Yeah, I have to say, they just seem really sexy in terms of, you know, the laptops, everything they announced. And I would kind of, although I have no immediate need for one, I really just kind of want to get one. And that to me is a mark of good design and good marketing.
Yeah,
and then they also went through the situation where they showed you the manufacturing process. And those, I mean, it looked like I was watching one of the Tesla videos about how they manufacture that car.
Yep.
The way they anodize the aluminum, the way they, like, melt and construct it. You know, all those little shavings are going to go back into something and help make the next Mac Pro that's on the line. All that stuff. So it really is a device that screams of high quality. So we'll have to just wait and see what's up. It's one of those things.
New Macs aren't the only things that they announced that are shipping today. After being announced in June, OS X Mavericks is finally seeing release. The latest version of Apple's operating system is an iteration on Mountain Lion, but it refines the software and adds what Apple promises are significant performance improvements. Even better is the price point. It's free. Apple wants to get all users on the latest operating system, so it's handing out downloads to anyone with a Mac from the past several years. OS X has never been particularly expensive, but with the previous versions shipping for $20 to $30, it's a significant change in the business model. So let me ask you guys, first of all, in general, what did you think? Have you guys, either of you guys, downloaded Mavericks yet for your operating system? And secondly, what do you think about this change in the business model, in free versus what other operating systems like Microsoft are charging? You know, Microsoft Windows 8 can cost anywhere from $119 to $199 depending on the iteration.
I think the bigger focus here is not like whether we played with Mavericks or not, because even if we played with it, we haven't had enough time to really get into it. It really is this cost thing.
Yeah.
A Macintosh computer is a computer made by Apple, right? They're making their money on the hardware, just like with iOS. This is a back to the Mac thing. We're making the money on the hardware, guys. Let's just get the operating system to be as tight as possible and people will you know, pay the money for the hardware. That's what's going on here. If you're Microsoft, at the Surface, you dabbled in that area, and you have a lot to learn.
That's
really what's going on. They have a lot to learn. I don't think they're out of the game. They just bought Nokia, so they're certainly not out of the game when it comes to mobile. But you know, they have a lot to learn when it comes to changing that business model. Microsoft's bread and butter has been selling this operating system to businesses for 30-plus years.
Yeah.
They really have to figure out how they want to attack that. Apple has not been doing that. Apple's been doing the opposite. These updates have not cost a lot because people have spent money on their devices. What's big here is that they're letting you gain access to this stuff on machines that are as old as in the year 2007. That's 6 years going back. That's basically any unibody Mac laptop, any unibody Mac laptop. Some of the old school white plastic and black plastic laptops get access to Mavericks as well, right? Like, I mean, I don't. You have to look at which processors are going to be supported and everything like that. But that's how far back they're going. So you could have a computer that is a unibody MacBook Pro, and you bought it the same day your cousin bought the black Mac. That's how old those systems are, and you know you're able to upgrade, and they're not. It used to be that they went back 2 or 3 years. They're going back 7. This is 6 years. This is a big deal.
Yeah.
This is the crux of what they're saying. That if you spend the money on a Mac, you will have continued value for a very long time. We're not going to leave you hanging the way you might find on, you know, with the Vista, the XP to Vista transition, or, you know, stuck in Android 2.3 like so many handsets are. You're not going to be stuck. You get to move forward. Spend your money on a Mac. That's what they're saying.
I want to quote a article written by Austin Carr in Fast Company called All of the Ways Apple's New Free Mac OS Hurts Microsoft Windows. He says, with all future Mac OS upgrades remaining free, it's easy to see how this pricing model would be appealing to the public. Imagine a corporate IT buyer choosing between purchasing Macs and Windows-based PCs for employees. Rather than having to upgrade from XP to Vista to Windows 7 with all the associated headaches and expenses, a new Mac can stay as fresh as possible without putting a hole in your wallet. The cost of upgrading Windows is one reason why Microsoft has so many fragmentation issues. The latest version of Windows has just an 8% adoption rate amongst Windows users. XP and Windows 7 are still the dominant platforms with a whopping 77% market share. That's a pain for developers who don't want to design apps for a new OS, which so few have gravitated towards, not to mention a nightmare for Microsoft, considering that so few customers think upgrading Windows is worth the price tag. So is this really Mac's secret?
Or worth the pain, really?
Yeah.
Not just the price tag, the pain. I mean, you talked about earlier how people are having bricked devices.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And we, you know, I haven't really seen the news on that. What I have seen the news on is anytime Apple's ever screwed up about anything, right? So there is that.
And you know what is kind of pretty outstanding about all of this is not just is, you know, Apple is now kind of as they've done with their iOS releases, dictating what release that they want you to be on. So they're creating this sort of unified, you know, unified upgrade progression, meaning that they no longer really have to support their earlier releases to the same degree or at least magnitude that Microsoft has to do so, because, you know, hey, if I'm giving you this for free, you can go ahead and upgrade. Well, for a majority of people, they will go ahead and upgrade.
Yep.
And then if for those who choose not to upgrade, well, you know, Apple can say, hey, there is this free OS out there that you could have moved to.
Also a thing that's a tie to that is ease of upgrade, right? Like, ease is a really big thing here.
Yeah.
You can go and you can just upgrade. There's a little notification, just like every other app. You just do it. And that's a big deal. I don't have to worry about, hey, do I have to go get some patch? Do I have to transfer my settings?
Right.
You go
to the App Store and you click on update. That's it.
Now, I guess the real question which I have is, you know, whether or not this trend will continue. Is this something where Apple is going to continue to give OS upgrades for free, or is it, you know, to get you to a certain point, they'll give it for free, but like sort of like every other, right? So like the smaller upgrade paths you get
every
for free,
other
but...
was their every other was their old school way of doing it. Right. I think free really means free. Spend your money on a Mac.
Yeah.
Your upgrades are free, just like on iOS. I don't think there's ever going to be a cost.
And in this case, Apple definitely has the upper hand because they sell the hardware and the software that goes on the hardware. But here, they know that you're going to buy the hardware. That's where they're making their money. So why not give the software away for free? Whereas Microsoft is just barely – they're in the nascent era of – creating hardware for their software, so they've got a lot of catching up to do.
Yeah, and this is not the only software Apple's giving away free. They're giving away more software free for their Macs. So why don't we get into that?
Yeah. So all of the apps of the iLife and iWork suite have been redesigned for both OS X and iOS, with the focus on 64-bit architecture. Apple says the new iPhoto and iMovie apps will be better at browsing and sharing, and GarageBand now has 32 tracks on iOS and a new sound library on the Mac, along with features like custom drummers, virtual drummers that you can have play along with your tracks. iWork has been rewritten. New effects and animations can be found throughout the apps, which are available for free with the purchase of a new Mac or iOS device. Pages, Numbers, and Keynotes are integrated with the respective web versions. And iWork also added collaboration features. Oh, this was pretty amazing during the keynote. This is essentially stealing business away from Google Documents. So iWork now has the collaboration features that you can connect with somebody online and collaborate over Pages, Numbers, Keynotes, and the rest of the iWork suite in the same way that people do now with Google Docs. And Apple had previously not had this functionality in their work suite. So this is a huge boost for them.
You can never go wrong with free, right? And just it's good putting your software into the hands of your customer and not charging outrageous fees for it. So I think Apple made a lot of really good moves at their conference. So
I mean, it's in large part it's an investment. They're actually taking a lot from the Google and Amazon models in terms of loss leader, right? They could probably make some money off of their software, but that's never been where they're trying to like make a huge profit center. Software's always been good. Software's always been excellent. But what they're doing here is saying that it's about more than that. We want to get you in the ecosystem. That's where the money is.
Yeah.
Get you in here with some really, really tight examples of what's possible. Give the developers the best options of what, you know, the best examples of what to be done and the best tools to make that done, get done. And then, you know, users are going to show up. And those users, if they can use native apps like iWork, they can use native apps like iLife, they're going to use them. They're going to use native apps. The idea that Maps is now a native app on your Mac, that's a big deal. I don't know how many times I've reopened email or Maps in web browsers because I just can't find the browser that I opened before, that tab. Mm-hmm. This is simple. And they have a, you know, in iOS especially, they've proven that native apps are really powerful. So I think what they're trying to do here is just say, get into our ecosystem. We will take care of you. That's the pervasive message from all this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, the greatest way to get people to buy your hardware, I think, is with basically promising to support you on the software side.
Tim Cook mentioned that 70 million iOS devices now ran iOS 7. Mm-hmm. That is the biggest upgrade in the history of computing. It is affected by not only the ease of use, it's affected by the cloud, the use of the cloud, the fact that it's mobile. It's not a humongous piece of software. It's not like 25 gigs or anything like that. And it's tied into the fact that they set a paradigm earlier, and that paradigm has allowed them to do this kind of scale. So while we're talking about how few people are on OS X. We're also talking about how many people are upgrading via iOS. And we'll see the numbers with Mavericks very soon, now that we know it's free.
Yeah. Yeah, but that having been said, OS X still, OS X, I should say, still has a minority share of the total market share of OSs out there.
That's fine, because it has double-digit growth almost every year. They're eating into Microsoft's market share slowly but surely. And when it comes to looking at how consumers rather than businesses use OSs, you know, they are becoming ever more popular. So, you know, as long as they show growth, they're in a good place. You're not going to build Rome overnight.
Yeah.
Rome wasn't built in a day, is really what I meant to say.
I got it. I got the analogy. All right. So let's talk about the iPads, which is the big news of the of this fall event.
Big, surprising, new, sexy hardware.
Yes. So
I hate using the word sexy with hardware, but I couldn't help myself.
In this case, yeah. So the 9.7-inch iPad is still around, but it's seen its first major redesign since the iPad 2, and it's now called the iPad Air. It's a couple millimeters thinner, almost half a pound lighter, and looks like an outsized iPad mini with a smaller bezel and squared-off edges. Like the iPhone, it's running 64-bit architecture on an A7 chip. It's the iPad 2 is still around. The iPad 2 remains on sale at $399. The iPad Air ships November 1st. Starts at $499 with a 16 gig Wi-Fi version and a cellular one for $629. I'm a little funky about how I feel about the new name, the iPad Air. Like, that feels to me like a marketing move.
Well, I mean, it is 30% lighter.
It's 0.4 pounds lighter. Right. Does that justify?
Well, hear me
giving
out.
It the name.
Guys, come on. They make a device that is 1.5 pounds. They took away half a pound.
Point four, it's half a pound.
I'm rounding. All right, fine. You're taking away. But regardless of what that number is, you now have it. I don't know if you've tried to hold your iPad 3 or 4 for a long amount of time. Mm-hmm. Now you can do it for possibly 30% more because it's lighter. It's a third lighter than it used to be. I mean, that's really significant when you're working at these margins. You're not going to get crazy big gains in miniaturization, you know, every single year. But when you get one, it's not a question of, hey, we made the bezel a little thinner, or hey, we did this. They said, we're going to make this half a pound lighter and give you all the battery life, all the camera, all the processing power. We're going to be able to do all that. Now, how is that possible? It's possible because they've got this 64-bit chip that doesn't need as much power to run. They've got some other stuff going on in there. But the fact is, when you drop anything by a third, even if it's by, you know, half a pound or a little less than half a pound, that's a big deal. You tell me what would happen if I dropped your car by a third of its size.
That's fine, but I'm going to argue that that calling it the iPad Air is a total marketing move and nothing more than that, because there was a recent report that showed that iPad sales are actually slumping. They're dropping.
They're plateauing. They're not slumping.
According to this,
I mean, the growth is definitely slowing the iPad because everybody and their mother has an iPad.
Right. Right? So how do you inspire a saturated market to buy a new version of the same product? You give it a new name, a fresh name, new marketing. It's the iPad Air now.
I would believe you, except for that planned obsolescence is usually the way manufacturers go. And in this case, Apple decided to keep around a 2010 device. Now, their 2009 device was the iPhone 3GS, and that was the workhorse. Yeah. It was around forever. The fact that the iPad 2 is still available.
Yeah, because it makes sense to have two.
What I'm saying is they're not just throwing it out. They're not just saying, hey, get this new thing because we're going to give you some new stuff. You know, we're going to give you new stuff and get rid of all the old stuff. They're saying, you know what? If you like the old stuff, have it. But we need to distinguish now because we've had 5 iPads and we only numbered one of them. It's getting confusing. So now, instead of calling it the iPad Big against the iPad Mini, or instead of calling it the new iPad, which isn't going to work, because they keep on releasing them within less than a year. Mm-hmm. They're like, look, it's crazy light compared to the other ones on the market. You can buy the iPad 2. It's lighter than that. That's the other 10-inch iPad there.
Throwing air on at the end of it is essentially their way of denoting it as the new hotness. Which, you know, I'm okay with. I just rather them be a little more transparent about it than making it out to be a new product entirely.
It is a new product. It's completely redesigned. It runs different hardware inside and out. We haven't gotten the breakdown of it yet, but there's probably multiple gigs of RAM in this puppy. This is a different beast, guys.
I think I'm half and half there. I definitely agree on one hand that it is a changed device. But then again, part and parcel with calling it the Air is also that naming convention of this is sleek and it's, you know, it's comparable to the other new Air that we received. So I think it's half and half.
They are unifying their branding, which is good. We've talked about this with other companies. Why can't they do that? It's interesting. Where could they have gone, right? Could they have gone to iPad Pro? Probably not, because that would turn off a lot of people. Oh, I don't need a Pro device. They go with Air. They're like, oh, it's so light. I got to go check out how light it is. And we all remember when the iPhone 5 came out, everybody and their mother was like, man, it's just so light. It's so light.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It was basically they were like, why this is like that. They're like, why don't we lean into that lightness, these new manufacturing processes and everything we're doing. We're gonna lean in. We're gonna call it the iPad Air because we have to distinguish it from the four other iPads we're selling.
Well, I mean, it's certainly a I think it's a welcome change to last year's nomenclature, which was just the new iPad, because that was confusing as hell.
I know it was confusing because they had the new iPad in March. And they had the new iPad in October of last year. So it's like, dude, just give it a name. Give it a number. Do something.
The iPad Air wasn't the only thing they revamped. They also revamped the iPad Mini. And now it's got the Retina display that everyone had.
The thing that everybody said that was never going to happen.
Oh, no.
It's just too early.
I was the first on the bandwagon to say that it was a mistake that the Mini didn't have a Retina display. It should have had a Retina display to begin with.
Well, nothing this that was... they've ever made. You can't – like the Retina display is an expensive piece of hardware.
No.
They're not going to launch with a Retina display on anything. They have to prove that it's going to work. Mm-hmm. They have to prove that the device is going to work. And the iPad Mini was a brand new device. So I don't know about that. But everybody was like, well, it's just too early. It's just too early to get the Retina display. And now – This is that was a surprise. Let's face it. How many times have we complained about the lack of surprises coming out of Cupertino?
In years past, yeah, we have. No, for sure, the revamped iPad Air was definitely a surprise, as was the free Mavericks, the free software Mavericks in iLife and iWork. So they did have some legitimate surprises this year. The iPad Mini is updated to a 64-bit A7 chip. They bumped up the price to $399 for a 16-gig Wi-Fi model and $529 for one with mobile data. The original iPad Mini is still selling it, although they're selling it at $299. It's still $70 more than the Nexus 7. But there you go. Now you have your choices. All of those. I mean,
there's a lot of choice now. It's not old school Apple style where it was like, here is the computer. Thank you. Good night.
Yes. Yes.
It's like, here is one of 12 computers. Here's one of 19 iPads. Hey, we got two different phone lines now. You know, so these markets are growing. Apple stock is up above 500 consistently for several days now. You know, and that's all good news for Apple. These are big. This is a strange year because everything's been revamped. And if anybody had said the era of Jobs is over, there's no new stuff coming out of Apple, they have to think again because they revamped everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that A7 chip is going to mean something different for some other devices.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think we're in line to see more new. Absolutely new products from the ground up as well. Like, you know, we know their watch is coming, and we suspect that some sort of iteration of a new television device maybe in the works a little bit further down the road.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if I were Apple, I would have leaked conversations about a watch.
Yeah.
Just to get people off the scent.
Yeah. Yeah. So before we wrap up tonight, what did you guys think in general about the whole Apple Fall event and all the stuff that they announced?
Another good showing.
For me, the big thing was they really took advantage of the personalities that are the leadership team in bringing them up to the front of the place. You know, like Federini, aka Hair.
Yeah.
You know, bringing Phil Schiller, not Phil Schiller, bringing Paul the hardware guy who had claimed he was going to retire, and then they brought him back. He was out there talking about everything. There was one thing that really. It bothered me. He goes, "I'm a big fan of Batman. I love the Black Knight."
That was like, a little embarrassing.
Who's the Black Knight? Am I the Black Knight? Is Tosin the Black Knight? Who's the Black Knight?
That showed how much of a big fan he was, didn't it?
I mean, I guess he was a little nervous. He's like talking about stuff. He's back on the stage after a while. But it was really funny as a geek to be like, ooh.
Yeah.
But that's going to be a meme from now on. Like, that's going to show up on 4chan, I guarantee it. But no, they really worked well to not only say, we're giving you all this great stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it costs money, but the software is all free. What you can do with it is free. I really feel like they took it back to that iPod situation where, yeah, this hardware is expensive, but you know what? You don't have to worry about taking your CDs and putting them on it. There's going to be a store. You just buy it from the store, and it gets in there, and it's easy. They're taking that aspect, that approach. That's really good. And then they're just making sure the personalities of the leadership team are more than just a couple, you know, crazy people or money-grubbing people. These are people who are really using the products in meaningful ways. So much so that, you know, Federini's credit card number just showed up on screen. He's like, "Well, the good news is I have to put in my code, so yay." And that showed you that either that was a master of marketing or that's the actual computer he uses every day.
I think unlike what other people are saying about, you know, maybe Apple has lost this innovation streak that was coming out earlier in the maybe spring or, you know, summer. I think they're still got a lot of you may not be seeing products that are coming out like the original iPhone because, you know, that was really right place, right time.
Yeah.
Sort of a once in a lifetime
perfect
sort
storm.
Of thing. Yeah, but I think they still are producing great hardware and doing a lot of they're pushing. They may not be pushing it in terms of new devices, but they're really being innovative and creative with, you know, not only shrinking things but also maximizing the performance out of you know what we're used to.
It's an era of refinement.
I'm really curious to see how this free software, free OS thing affects the playing field in especially Windows, because Windows does not have the hardware. Sales to leverage doing something like that for themselves. They've got to rely on charging people for their software.
I mean, if Microsoft can move more into the hardware, they can think about that. I think Microsoft has. I mean, the thing about Apple is that Apple has to continue to showcase good software experiences because you can get any software under the sun on Windows. Like you said, Windows is still at the top of the heap. In terms of like adoption, Windows computers are cheaper. In many ways, it's, you know, a mimic of the Android iPhone situation, except that the software on in the Windows side isn't like it doesn't suffer from a lot of the crappy stuff that you hear about the software on the iOS side. I mean, on the Android side. I'm sorry. So people are used to it. The experience on the software on the productivity software Outlook, Excel.
Yeah.
It simply can't be beaten. I mean,
that's true.
Excel is that's the true. Photoshop, the industry standard for getting business done. And Apple, you know, you look at that stuff, it looks really cool and you really like it, but it does seem like a lot more fun than it seems like work. And yeah, they're trying to bridge the two. Hey, work should be fun. You should feel creative. You should feel like you're interested in moving. But in their appliance focus with the iOS devices tied to their other focus, you know, these desktops that are really powerful and that are great for artists. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of room in there for the average schmo who's got to, you know, run that report off the database. So it's something to think about. You know,
they still need to get, if they want to take over the world, they still need to get there. And how do they do that? They need to sell this free stuff, this free hardware, this free software.
Mm-hmm.
You can do all this stuff and you don't have to pay for it. Just get our hardware because that's where we make our money. Yep. Microsoft has a different challenge. Their challenge is to continue to get people on their stuff. And, you know, they really have to make sure that they don't fall. A lot of the stuff that Apple's doing in the OS X, Microsoft could do too. There should be no reason why you have to install something to tweet properly.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. It's there's a lot of stuff that they could do. But especially because when it comes to the Facebook integration, Microsoft has a significant investment in Facebook.
Sure.
why aren't they already in there? So, I don't know. You get Windows Live Essentials and things do become easier. But it doesn't have that same level of family feeling integration. And that's where Microsoft has to work, and they have to find a way to get that value to people, make some money, and not have people feel like they're being ripped off.
All right. Well, with that, let me go around the table here, and I'll start with you, Tosin. Where can we find you online when you're not here on The Drill Down?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, as well as at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
And Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online when you're not here on The Drill Down?
You can always find me at Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, DWAYNED. And you can also find me at flavors.me/DwayneD. That's pretty much shows you everything I do. That's flavors.me/DWAYNED.
As for myself, you can find me at twitter.com and facebook.com at Mr. Babyman, or just do a Google search for Mr. Babyman. You'll find all my social media online work there. As for the show, if you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on The Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. Let our podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.